Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. That's why Poetry Magazine is proudly called Chicago home for more than 100 years. Poetry publishes contemporary poetry, including talents like Ada Limone, Ocean Vuong, and Avery R. Young. New subscribers to Poetry Magazine also receive an exclusive tote bag. Get yours at poetrymagazine.org/totes4poets. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is Curious City. As a warning for sensitive listeners, this episode describes police torture. Chicago has had a lot of nicknames. Here's one that nobody would want.
Defense attorneys call the city the false confession capital of the United States.
That was from a 60 Minutes segment back in 2012. For decades, people were tortured under the direction of disgraced Chicago Police Commander John Burge.
Burge and his men were accused of choking, shocking, burning, and beating people, most of them African Americans, until they confessed.
Burge's legacy is long, painful, and ongoing. But 10 years ago, the city passed a first-of-its-kind ordinance to try to help right these wrongs.
Chicago's city council voted today to pay $5.5 million to victims of police torture.
$5.5 million, divided by Burge's dozens of victims, comes out to $100,000 each, at most. In our last episode, we learned how money alone does not heal decades of trauma. And that's why Chicago's reparations ordinance included a bunch of other things as well. It required Chicago Public Schools to teach about Burge's crimes. It called for a Chicago torture memorial, and it included a provision that set up a mental health clinic for survivors.
We were founded in order to provide direct therapeutic services to survivors of police torture, people who have survived torture directly or have been impacted indirectly.
This is Aislinn Pulley. She's the executive director of the Chicago Torture Justice Center in Englewood. The center offers therapy, community support, and re-entry services to help people who have recently been released adapt to a world that has changed since they were wrongly incarcerated. Today, Aislinn is going to help us look closer at the limits of monetary payouts. What else survivors need to heal? And how Chicago's reparations ordinance is looking 10 years later. You might have seen the celebratory press conferences that happen after a settlement is won, but Aislinn says that does not account for all the healing that needs to happen.
After a settlement, there's a semblance of stability, but the scars of that trauma still linger. And so we have had and continue to have many participants in our programs who have received settlements, but continue to experience PTSD, continue to be woken up in the middle of the night, can't sleep through the night, experience agoraphobia, panic attacks. That's very, very common. So the psychological impacts linger on much longer. And we know now, thanks to the field of epigenetics, that it also has impact on the family. It has impact on offspring, on grandchildren. So that healing process after this, you know, quote unquote victory does not mean the healing process has ended by any means. The healing process continues to be lifelong and often intergenerational.
We talked in our last episode about some of the mental health crises that people experience after having been released. But then there's also just the financial struggles. Can you talk about that as well? You know, what a settlement means for someone who has been having a decades-long sentence that they were just released out of?
you know, it brings with it a number of new problems, right? Sometimes which you can look at as good problems, but problems nevertheless. What normally happens is that people, you know, experience it as a huge win and live on it for some years and then resort back to similar socioeconomic origins. And that's just true across the board. It's not unique to survivors. It's not unique to people who've been incarcerated. It's just kind of unique to the way that humans handle windfalls. There are smaller portions of the population who are able to get into financial ventures and make investments and et cetera and do that. And that's great. But the overwhelming majority, and this goes for any windfall, basically resort back to whatever socioeconomic reality that they came from. So it's not a long-term fix. And that's the key.
But Aislinn says that compensation is still important as a way to hold the system accountable.
And right now, that's usually the ultimate form of redress that's available for people. But it reflects the flaws in our society, right? It doesn't answer the fact that we live in a very unequal society and that we have social and class stratification that disproportionately affects certain populations more than others, right? Those things still remain true. So after the windfall, you know, happens and people stabilize and go back to wherever the socioeconomic roots were, those realities still exist. Housing continues to be an issue. Employment continues to be an issue. Healthcare continues to be an issue. So all of the issues that affect the larger population remain.
Money is not going to solve everything.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that it's individualized approaches don't solve what is a structural and systemic problem.
As far as the ordinance, it mandated a lot of things: an official apology, reparations for survivors, free access to higher education in city colleges for survivors and their families. This happened 10 years ago, 2015. Here we are, 10 years later. As far as you can tell, is the ordinance working the way that it's supposed to?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. It took a long time to get to the place we are now with the potential for breaking ground to create the public memorial. Rahm refused to meet with us about it.
Aislinn is talking about former Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And she says, even though former Mayor Lori Lightfoot promised a public memorial during her campaign, she didn't follow through.
It's only under Mayor Brandon Johnson that the city has actually moved on this. So now the memorials will be able to break ground soon. And that is a victory. But it took 10 years to get here. When it comes to the curriculum, we've created, along with CPS and CTU and other academics, a curriculum that's taught in all 8th and 10th grade Chicago Public School social studies classes. And it teaches the history of the fight for reparations, the history of Chicago police torture, and where it currently is now. And it's a really, that's one of the most transformative aspects of the reparations ordinance is the curriculum. But there has been some, you know, there's been disproportionate representation in the schools. Some schools we have a regular relationship with and a deep connection and relationship with. And then there are some schools that we just haven't yet had access to. We haven't been invited to go in. And so we hope to, you know, it really dramatically expand that in the coming years and be able to get into every single school.
A decade since the ordinance was enacted, Aislinn says it's still important for the city to continue funding the Chicago Torture Justice Center.
Mayor Brandon Johnson has been a staunch supporter of ours, and that has followed up in our ability to continue to receive funding from the city of Chicago for our therapeutic services, which is vital. And there is the very real reality that if we experience a mayor that is more Trump-leaning or more right-wing, they could very well just say that the city has fulfilled its obligation. and no longer needs to fund this program. And that argument has been levied before during other mayoral administrations. What we know, though, is that trauma can exist for a long time, and the treatment of trauma can really be a lifelong and sometimes intergenerational process of healing. Therefore, it's my belief that the funding to support the therapeutic work that goes into healing from that trauma needs to continue to be supported and funded until that reality no longer exists, until we no longer have instances of excessive abuses by the state onto its population.
For the folks who are still in that healing process, first of all, what do you think is the biggest challenge for them?
In this moment, I think one of the biggest challenges is the increase in violence that is being justified by our federal government, the weaponizing of our National Guard and other federal forces to operate within a domestic municipal context is a change from the ways in which these bodies have been allowed to exist in prior years. That is very, very terrifying for people who have survived torture, violence, and other forms of injustice at the hands of state agents. And that's not just speaking of people in Chicago who have experienced abuse by the hands of police, but people who have also emigrated here from other countries and have experienced violence by other actors in those home countries. And so we're seeing a lot of people being triggered in this moment. And that has a very, very destabilizing effect on people's sense of safety and security. The previous safeguards that were in place to prevent against that are being challenged directly by our federal government and by our president.
If you were to list all of the things that a person who is reentering or who has been through this trauma and this abuse needs, you know, what is needed for healing to begin and continue?
The ultimate thing that we need is for this violence to stop. And that is a 100% possible reality. There are other examples in the world right now that we can look to where their societies don't have the same amount of state violence, be it through federal forces or through local police forces. The amount of violence that we experience in the United States is really enormous. This is such a pivotal and important moment in our country and in our city. And how John Burge, the way that the torture was able to be justified was under the guise of the war on the poor, the war on drugs, and the rise of mass incarceration, the tough on crime rhetoric that was so emblematic of the 80s and 90s. And we're seeing a return of that rhetoric now. And we're also seeing a return of, quite frankly, torturous acts. No one deserves to be tortured, nobody. And this moment is one that really requires us to dig deep into our own moral compass and unite together to prevent additional atrocities from happening.
Aislinn Pulley is the executive director of the Chicago Torture Justice Center. Aislinn, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This episode of Curious City was produced by me and Justin Bull. Susie Ahn is our editor. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, send them our way at curiouscity@wbez.org or visit us at wbez.org/curiouscity. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.
Rise and Shy, WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.